やる。
Okay, we're holding here in Perek Zion of the Berah Goyla, of the Netzach Yisrael, excuse me, Perek Zion of the Netzach Yisrael, and we're just sort of wrapping up this last piece, this Mi'as Hashem is the last session we're going to do on this Perek, and the last session that this Gemara is going to do as part of at least a continuing analysis of this Agadita in Maseches Gittin, of this passage in Maseches Gittin about the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara says as follows: Hakol Kol Yaakov Vayadayim Yidei Esav. The voice of Yaakov in the hands of Esav. Hakol Ze Adrianus Kesar. This refers to Hadrian. Shaharag Alexandria Shomitzrayim Shishim Riba al Shishim Riba Kiflaim Kiyetza Mitzrayim. He killed in Alexandria 600,000 times 600,000, or 600,000 on top of 600,000, double the amount of people that left Mitzrayim. Kel Yaakov refers to Aspasianus Kesar, Vespasian, Shaharag Bekrach Fetar, Arba Meis Ribay, Vamila Arba Salafim Ribay, 400 multitudes, or some say 4,000 multitudes. That refers to the Kol Yaakov. In other words, this interpretation of Hakol Kol Yaakov is, as Rashi says, Kol Tzavacha Ubechi Oilam Yaakov Ro Yitzchak Benefua. Yaakov's voice, meaning the cries of Yaakov. Hakol Kol Yaakov, basically, as it falls in the hands of Esav. Yitzchak was anticipating the cries of Yaakov Avinu and Yaakov Avinu's descendants from these terrible destructions, carnages, if you would say, that emerged from them. And the Yadayim de Esav Zumalchus HaRashah, this refers to the hands of Esav, Shechrivas Beitenu, they destroyed our house, Vesarfas Echleinu, and burnt our temple, Viglisonomi Artenu, and sent us out from our land. So the hands of Esav, it seems, are referring to the physical destruction of items, of the Migdash, of the Heichal, of the Eretz Yisrael. And the Kol Yaakov refers to the victims, the people who were killed by them. So the Maharal just makes a note, and this is like a continuing note, if you will, in the sugya of Krach Beitar, of the city of Beitar. Remember that the Maharal has this thesis, which we have referred to already several times, that Beitar represents the physical building up of the land of Eretz Yisrael. It was a city that was built as a krach, as a strong physical structure. So whereas we had the Migdash, which was the place from which the Shefa, the flow of blessing, came down to this world, and we had generally, you know, in Parnassa and everything else, and we had Paramelech, which was representing the population explosion that would exist in Eretz Yisrael. Krach Beitar represented the building up, the physical building up of the cities of Eretz Yisrael. That's the way he understands it. So he uses this, or he adds to this, to explain a feature of this Gemara's description. You know, Alexandria of Mitzrayim was outside of Eretz Yisrael. It's described as a place in a number of places in the Gemara, including here in Gittin elsewhere, that where there was a tremendous Jewish community in Alexandria of Mitzrayim. Huge, right? The example of a large Beis HaKnesses, a large gathering place for tefillah, is the Shul of Alexandria. However, the numbers it uses there are typical for a populace, you know, 600,000, or maybe twice 600,000, I'm trying to show how major it was. But when it comes to Krach Beitar, it speaks about 40 multitudes or 400 multitudes. You know, it's using a different figure, a different scheme. And the Maharal explains, consistent with the way we explain it about Beitar. Why? Shekemoi sheminyan shishim riba mora al ribu, kmoi shispoi leil kach minin arba meir riba mora al mokom hamiyushav. The same way we use Shishim Ribo, 600,000, to refer to the numbers of people, however, 4 is representing a settled place. It's talking more about the number of people as a sign of how developed the place was. Because when we speak about places, we use the 4. Because of the 4 directions, right? The Arba Kanfes Aretz, we speak about the 4 corners of the earth, right? It's north, south, east, west. That's those are the dimensions of place. And since Beitar is being described as the place that was the strongest, the place that was the most built, so therefore in describing Beitar, we use the description of place. And we even use the people, the Anoshim, Hayeshma, Mishuarim, Gamkein, B'mispar Dalet. Since we're describing the people in terms of the place, the focus on Beitar is on the destruction of the city and the inhabitants to the extent that they make the city, so therefore we use the numbers 4 here, factors of 4, rather than the factors of 6. That's what the Maharal says, just as a note, sort of like, again, filling out this, you know, this Beitar thing, picking up on this nuance in Chazal to fill that through. The Gemara continues. Okay, we're going to do here a couple of snippets and maybe a few snippets and maybe one larger theme. The next thing the Gemara says is, well, that's one interpretation of Akol Kol Yaakov Ayadayim Ve'Esav. It's a rather, indeed, pessimistic interpretation of Akol Kol Yaakov. Right? It's all just speaking about the downside of the equation for the Jews. The cries, the bitter cries of the Jewish people. The brutal hands of Esav. However, there's another way to interpret it, says the Gemara, and that, I think, is the more famous way. Says the Gemara, Dover Acher, Akol Kol Yaakov, Ein Lecha Tfila Shem Oela She'en Bamizaro Shel Yaakov. There is no prayer that accomplishes that doesn't have within it of the descendants of Yaakov. Ve'en Lecha, Ve'aydaim Ve'esav, Ein Lecha Melchama She'en Aitzachas She'en Bamizaro Shel Esav. And there's no war that will be victorious that doesn't have within it of the descendants of Esav. In other words, the power of prayer is a power of Yaakov Avinu, is a power of the Jewish people. And the power of the sword, the power of destruction, is a power of Esav. And that's the way we are to understand the Pasuk of Akol Kol Yaakov Ayadayim Yidei Esav. Whereas simply Yitzchok is just commenting on the ambiguity which he has in front of him of this child that sounds like Yaakov, his voice and the way he talks, and feels like Esav, the way his hands are hairy, right, because they were covered, of course, with the goatskins, right? Well, we understand that the way you look to identify Yaakov is by the voice, because the voice is his single great power. And the way we look to identify Esav is by the hands, because that is his single great power. And the Gemara goes further, and it says that really it's a unique power. Only the Zera Yaakov will be found indeed in the power of Tefillah. Only the Zera of Esav will be found in the power of the sword, one way or the other. It's hard to understand and to really apply this Gemara. The Maharal doesn't speak about this aspect of it much, but for instance we know that there's such a thing as a power of Tefillah which belongs to Yishmael. I think we discussed it before in the Be'er HaGoyle a little bit. The power of tefillah that belongs to Yishmael. He's not Mizera Yaakov. He's not one of the descendants of Yaakov Avinu. And what did we just read about yesterday in the Parsha? We read about Milchemes Amalek, the war against Amalek. And it was a war which the Jewish people fought in hand-to-hand combat. And Amalek happens to be a descendant of, doesn't happen to be, but is a descendant of Esav, is a grandchild of Esav. And yet, it says, Yeshua was able to weaken them by the sword. It's true, of course, that the Yodav Shel Moshe, the hands of Moshe, were up there on the mountaintop. And the hands of Moshe were not hands of Yidei Esav, but they were hands which were raised in prayer. Which is a very interesting twist that the Parsha provides us with. Right, we know that the voice of Yaakov is going to be triumphing over the hands of Esav. Here, in this battle, where the Jewish people use hands of Esav, but at the same time, as Yahushua is down there using the sword, right, the hands of Esav, but at the same time, Moshe Rabbeinu is using what we could only call the hands of Yaakov. Hands
Yadav Prusais L'Shamayim. His hands were raised to the heavens as a symbol, as the Mishnah says in Rosh Hashanah, of the entire viewpoint of everybody raised up towards the heavens. And that's the Bnei Yisrael winning. Now, was that the Milchama Shenotzachas, a war that was won, that had within it of the children of Esav? You know, how does that work? How does that work that it somehow, so to speak, has within it from the children of Esav? So, you know, in a narrow sense, it's very hard to read this Gemara. It's very hard to read this Gemara. But what the Gemara would seem to be saying in a non-literal sense, where it's expanded beyond meaning literally, you have to have a descendant of Esav in there or a descendant of Yaakov in there, is that there is the flavor of Esav or the flavor of Yaakov. Remember that Yaakov Avinu had stolen the brachos that were supposed to go to Esav. And the person who would actually be the one to realize those brachos which were stolen was not Yaakov. Yaakov stole the brachos of dew of the heavens and the fat of the land, but he wasn't a farmer. He wasn't a successful agriculturist. Who was? Yosef. Yosef was the ultimate farmer of the whole region in Mitzrayim. Yaakov stole from Esav the blessing that he would be the master over his brothers, that kingdoms would bow down to him, and that didn't happen to Yaakov. Yaakov was a stranger in Laban's house. He was not deferred to in Shechem or with Esav or with anybody else, but Yosef would. Yosef would have his brothers bow down to him. Yosef would have kingdoms bow down to him. And so on. There are so many aspects where we see, and really Yaakov Avinu says this in the bracha which he gives to Yosef at the end of his life. He says, Birchai Savicha Gavru al Bakai Sarai, Atavaski Vaisalam, Tiena L'Rash Yosef. Yosef is the one who has all those brachas that I stole from Esav. I didn't really keep them for myself. I didn't actually lay claim to them myself. Actually, they went over to Yosef. Yosef was the one who really got them. Yosef was the one who really had them. So therefore, Yosef, to some degree, is going to be the one who would exhibit the powers of Esav. And Chazal do tell us that the Zarei Shel Esav will only fall under the children of Yosef, the descendants of Rachel, it says, which is Yosef, right? Was the first of the descendants of Rachel. So Yehoshua beats Amalek, and Mordechai, who's from Binyamin, right, beats at Haman. Shaul is the one who's also from Binyamin, is supposed to fight the war against Amalek. Mashiach ben Yosef is going to have that role of fighting the Milchemes Amalek. So therefore, it doesn't mean literally the descendants of Esav. It means those who somehow have adopted the power of Esav. And, you know, Yaakov holding a sword clumsily is going to be different than Yosef, who somehow has a greater grip on it. And we'd have to say something like that with Yishmael as well. Something like that we'd have to say with Yishmael as well. But the idea itself, Kol Yaakov, Yadayim Yidei Esav. So Yadayim Yidei Esav we understand. Yadayim Yidei Esav is the hands, otherwise known as Al Charba Chotichya, you will live by the sword. It's destruction. Destruction. The hands of destruction and combat. Now, hands could presumably be used for good things too. Right? You know, something which is given me ad liad, a positive, you know, gift, a charitable gift, there is such a thing as using the hands for a positive thing. But in Esav's case, of course, it's al charba chatichya, you will live by the sword. Yaakov Avinu is characterized as having the ultimate kol, the kol Yaakov. The tefillah is always going to be from the children of Yaakov. So what does this mean? So the Maral here doesn't give an extensive explanation of it, but he alludes to. This is like an ongoing kind of a theme. And the Maral writes as follows. Ein tfila nishmas elim kein yesh b'mizar shel Yaakov zeh soid nifla. This is a very, very amazing secret. Ki ha-tfila hi rachmim, because tfila is rachmim. Prayer is rachmim, is mercy. Vezeu midas Yaakov shemidose ha-rachmim. And this is the characteristic of Yaakov. Yaakov is Rachamim. Yaakov is associated with the Mida, the characteristic of Rachamim. What's the idea that Yaakov Avinu is the Mida of Rachamim? So it's difficult. Rabbi Hartman has a very important footnote here, right? And he brings, of course, that the pasuk which would say it is that the Kel Shakayit in Lachem Rachmim, Yaakov Avinu wishes his sons that Hashem should give you Rachmim before the Ish. So you can only give what you have. So therefore that implies that Yaakov Sama has Rachmim. But what's the idea of Rachmim? What's the notion of Rachmim? So the first thing, let's just first establish that Tefillah is Rachmim. The Gemara always says this thing. Right? Tefillah is Rachmim. When the Gemara speaks about women being obligated in Tefillah, it says Gemara, Tefillah is Rachmim. It's a request for mercy. It's a request for mercy, and therefore, of course, it should be, you know, it would seem that it should be applying to women as well. But the Gemara, but the idea of Rachmim, I'll tell you what Rabbi Hartman says, and then we'll go a step further, a step different. He says that the idea of Rachmim is Ava. When the Gemara refers to, when we speak about one who is beloved to somebody, so it's called his Rechima. His Rechima is his beloved. Even though we use Rachmim as mercy, but Rachmim is really Ava. And that means it's connection, it's relationship. And Tefillah is built on Rachmim. It's built on connection. If you think about it, really, when we speak about it generally as Hakol Kol Yaakov, the voice is the voice of Yaakov. So the idea is that the voice is the power of Dibur, the power of speech. It's the power of Tefillah, yes. It's the power of Talmud Torah, yes. But the voice we use for the power of speech. And the power of speech is a very unique koyach, very unique strength. When Chazal and Lahavdil, the philosophers, referred to the hierarchy of things in the world, and they spoke about minerals, you know, inanimate objects, and plants, and animals, when they got to humans, the way they distinguished humans is not by the word humans like we do, but they referred to it as Midaber, as speaking beings. Speaking beings. That's what the kayach of a human being, right? The most famous Targum Unculus, when it says that Hashem blew into man the Nefesh Chaya, and he wants to describe that as this was the transcendent soul, he says, L'ruach memalala, the speaking spirit. The speaking spirit, Kael, tell me something. What do you use the power of speech for, most profoundly? Is for communication. Is for communication, which is the vehicle of connection, of people being of people connecting to one another. The Gemara Chazal, the Mishnah rather, even uses the term Ra'ua Midaberes. When it speaks about intimacy, it uses a euphemism of Midaberes, of speaking. Because speaking is the vehicle of being able to forge connections between people. When Hashem wanted to divide the world, that the world should not be uniform during the time of the Tower of Babel, what he did was he made it that there were obstacles in people being able to communicate with one another. He separated their languages. So now that meant that the world couldn't bond together as once. He was worried about the consequences of being able, of the world bonding together. The Kayach HaDibur, the power of speech, is the power of connection. And this is a very profound idea, which we're going to be talking about a little bit more as we proceed here, about that is going to be considered the unique koyach of man. The unique koyach of man is the koyach of connection. And that's the koel. And that's the power of tefillah. When we start our tefillahs, we begin and we speak about our connection to Hashem. Blessed are you, Hashem, our God, and the God of our fathers, the God of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Hashem, we have a covenant. We have a relationship. We have a connection. And so, that's the beginning, that's the opening of tefillah. Right? You daven to somebody because of his tremendous capability, which we describe in the second bracha of the Shemoneh Esrei. But we also daven to somebody when we feel we have an entree, when we feel we have an opening, when we feel we have a relationship. That's Rachamim. And if Yaakov Avinu, Rachamim is Ava, is connection. And if Yaakov Avinu is representing Rachamim, so we understand the idea of Kol Yaakov, of that idea of the voice of connection. Why would it be that Yaakov Avinu would therefore be considered having the, you know, so to speak, the Kol Yaakov, the voice of connection? Why would he have Ava? Why would it be that way? So here, he sort of leaves us a little bit. And so here's where I want to explain a little bit more, and this is really ideas which we have as well from Maharal and from others. First of all, Yaakov Avinu is the Shlishi Sheba Avais. He's the third of the Avais. And as we've discussed already numerous times, in the way the numbers work, we understand that when you have one, it's one thing alone. When you have two, it's two things separate. When you have three, you have the bridge between the two that existed before. Right? Yaakov Avinu is considered to be, to some degree, not just the third link in the chain as you're going down the chain, but he's also the unifier. The unifier of Avram and Yitzchak. His midah, oftentimes his characteristic, is often called Tiferes, which is the sort of glory of harmony, of bringing the two of them together. And when you think about Rachamim, that's what it really is. Avram Avinu had chesed, kindness. Yitzchak Avinu had din, judgment. Those are two polar extremes. You can be filled with kindness, and there's no din. There's no place for din, for judgment in the world of kindness. Chesed means you give somebody something whether they deserve it or not. Din means there's no kindness. If you deserve it, if you quote-unquote paid for it, if you earned it, so then you have it. Din has no room for kindness. They represent two extremes. So what does Yaakov Avinu represent? The harmony, the tiferes, or what we call often emes, right, truth, which is not extremes, but it's going to be chesed when appropriate, din when appropriate. What's that combination? That combination is rachmin, mercy. What we call simply mercy. What does mercy mean? It means you're not ignoring any kind of a standard of judgment. Right? That would be not mercy, that would be just again kindness. Forget about judgment. Mercy is, there is a standard, and we're going to look at the standard, but we understand that even if you don't quite live up to the standard, we're going to be able to nudge you along a little bit. But it's not the abandonment of standard. It's not the abandonment of standard. I often like to explain that that's the idea, what we have. You know, the famous question of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, which is, you know, why don't you have Yom Kippur before Rosh Hashanah? Right? Have the forgiveness before the day of forgiveness before the day of judgment. It would make it a lot easier to stand in judgment. But there's the idea that what we have on Rosh Hashanah is that we're held to the ideal standard, the standard of din. We don't ignore it. You know, you go into a store, right? So you go into Macy's, right? You want to buy a jacket, right, in Macy's. Oh, or you go into another place, and you pull up the sleeve of the jacket, and it has a tag on it. You know, the tag on it says $450, right? And then through the 450, there's a red line, and somebody wrote in red $150. So I don't understand. Why do they do that? Or if you go into, you know, a discount retailer, right? So you go into Sims, right? $450 nationally, but right, Sims price is $150. What are they doing? Very, very simple. You have to understand, we want to know what you're getting. And we want to know what kind of a discount we're giving you, you know, right? Or even if it's not, you know, the bluffer eyes sometimes of the stores. Or you go to the mechanic, right? He says, you know, you're my good friend, right? He says, I wanted to tell you, normally, you know, this would be $100, this job, but for you, I'm going to do it for 50. For you, I'm going to do it for 50. You're understanding the standard, and you're understanding the offset. Right? Chesed, the person will never tell you, oh, it really should be $100. Just, here, it's yours. Right? Din, the person says, $100, pay up. Right? Rachmim is, look, this is what it should be, but this is indeed what I'm asking you for. And indeed, that's what we do in Tefillah. Tefillah, to some degree, we're turning to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We can never say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, give it to us because we deserve it. That's the worst thing a person can try to do in Tefillah. We say, Rabbeinu Shalom, we understand, but, right? That's the nature of Rachman. So it takes things and it blends them together, it brings them together. And in a sense, that's the idea, that's the combination which is being forged here. And Rachmim comes when there's a framework of din, of judgment, but din has no friends. Din, you're supposed to be as estranged from the person as possible, right? The judge is supposed to view the people before him as if they're strangers. He can't do it to a karev, he can't do it to somebody who's close to him. But when we look for Rachmim, it's because we're preying on a relationship with the one. So that's the idea, what we say over here, that tefillah, that's nishmas, has the koyach of Yaakov Avinu because it integrates both of these things. It integrates both of these things together, the standard and the relationship. that both of them have to some degree come together. Now, this is a perfect segue that the Maharal gives us, really, into the closing line. What really, in certain ways, is the closing line of the sugyas, but then it's not the closing line because the sugya keeps going. Says the Gemara, V'hainu the Amar Rabbi Lazar, B'shut Lashayn Techavei. That's what Rav Elazar said, that b'shut lashayin techavei. What does that mean? Translates the Gemara, b'chirchurei lashayin, which means the fight, right? B'merivas lashayin, says Rashi, the arguments which are created by the tongue. Like it says, al tischar b'mereim. Shut lashayin is shevet maka. Shut is to shoot. You know, it's to hit. It's the hit. So hide from that, says Rashi. What's this mean? That's what Rav Elazar says. Says Rashi that the idea was because we just described the Churban. And what caused the Churban? Was the story of Kamtzu Var Kamtzu, which was a story of Lashon Hara, right? Where he went and he damaged by going and told on the Jews to the house of the king. Says the Gemara, so watch out for that. Watch out for that. So the Maharal says simply, what's the idea? That the Gemara just finished telling us about the third Churban, which is the Churban of Beitar. We described that there are three stages, three levels of Churban. There was the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash, there was the Churban of Har HaMelech, and there was the Churban of Beitar. That's the whole Gemara. And we explained and discussed that trio, you know, several times. So the idea is, says the Maharal, that the last two only happened on the heels of the first one. The Beis HaMikdash was the Ikar Churban. We know that was the main Churban. And then it led to the other two, because ultimately the Beis HaMikdash is that point of connection between Hashem and the world below. And therefore, in the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, everything else follows suit. So we see Har HaMelech and Beitar, those destructions as being just, again, trickle-downs from the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And what destroyed the Beis HaMikdash? Was Shut Lashon, was the damage inflicted by the tongue, was Lashon Hara. And therefore we can say, that was it. That's what destroyed everything. B'Shut Lashon Techavei. Lashon Hara destroyed everything. And that's the Gemara's footnote. Now the Gemara's going to continue on, but I wonder, therefore, if the Gemara jumps into it here, because it's a perfect opposite to what the Gemara just said. You know, the Gemara started with Hakol Kol Yaakov, ay ay ay, right? The voice of Yaakov of crying. That's the negative voice of Yaakov. The Gemara describes elsewhere, right? Bochay Sifke Balayla, right? The pasuk in Eicha, right? The second pasuk in Eicha, they cry at night. What was the mean crying at night? Why does it describe crying at night? So the Gemara says there's nothing as heartrending as a person who's crying at night. Why? Because if a person cries during the day, so then they're crying to somebody. At night is the person who's forlorn, la'aleinu, crying into their pillow. And there's nobody listening, right? So the b'chay sifka b'alayla, right? They're crying at night. They're crying at night, so a person hears somebody and they're just crying mournfully with nobody to cry to. Oh, you know, that can get anybody, so to speak, to cry. Other people cry with him. They can't respond to the cry, but they join in the cry. So the Kol Yaakov of the original rendition is the cry of, so to speak, of the hopeless, the cry of all these people there, you know, all the victims. And the contrast is the Kol Yaakov of Tefillah, which is where the power of speech, the same voice, instead of the cries of futility, are the cries of, we have somebody to cry to. Kimishka Hashem Elokeinu b'chol kareinu elav. Who's like Hashem? Whenever we call out to Him, Hashem listens. Right? The Kol Yaakov, there is somebody to call to. It's the voice, the power of speech used as the power of connection, of relationship. What's Lashon Hara? Lashon Hara is when the same power of speech, which is what distinguishes us as a human being, is used as a divisive tool, as a destructive tool. What happens to a person who says Lashon Hara according to when the Torah, when things are functioning with the open Yad Hashem the way they're supposed to? He becomes a mitzayra. What's the consequence upon a mitzayra? Michutz lamachana, right? Tzaras, leprosy. He sent outside of the camp. Why? Because he used the power of speech to isolate people from each other. He was a gossip monger, a talebearer. He used the power of speech to divide, and therefore we say he's not part of society. He's separate from everybody else. We make him a leper. We isolate him from others. The power of speech is supposed to be used to bond, to create connection between people. That's the whole koyach of an adam. That's the whole power of a person. And when a person uses lashon in the opposite way, so then that creates destruction. That creates bochay sifka balayla. That creates the person who's going to be lying mournfully, crying at night, because they have nobody to cry to. And that was the destruction. That's why the beginning of it is seen in the lashon. Because everything about the Migdash is chibur, is connection. And whether it's connection this way, or whether it's connection that way, whether it's vertical connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or horizontal connection between people. Remember, the story of Kamtzo Bar Kamtzo was both, right? It was the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash based on Sinas Chinam, based on the acrimony that existed between people, the needless hatred which existed between people. So this is the flip side. So that's it's so perfect that the Gemara ends HaKol Kol Yaakov Ayidai Midei Esav with the two interpretations of the Kol Yaakov, the voice of futility at the time of Churban, and the voice of connection, the power of Kol Yaakov, of connection to Hashem that exists, and then says, but the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed by Shut Lashon, by people using their tongues, using Lo'aleinu the Kol Yaakov in a way which was destructive, which was undermining. So it's clear that way. And this, we have to understand, this power of the communication, the connection, is the unique kayacha adam, the unique power of a person. I learned with you already more than once the Maharal who explains the Ramban who explains that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu created man uniquely, right? So he created him uniquely with an neshama. He created him uniquely with the power of speech, all true. Power of Bechira, all true. But there's one thing which we see beyond those things that was clearly a distinction in how man was created. And that is that when man was created, he was created as one being, and then he was split up, male and female. Whereas animals were created, males, females. And the Ramban explained that the idea was because animals don't really connect to each other. They mate, but they get together and they separate. They get together and they separate. By man, the idea is we're supposed to be able, v'hayu l'basar echad, that the process of connection is supposed to be to create real relationship. A man and his wife are supposed to create real relationship. It's not a liaison. It's not a one-night stand. It's supposed to be togetherness that is forged. That's the unique kayach of man with his wife and in general, because that's the power of dibur. That's the power of speech. The power of speech is to forge relationship. And when a person uses the power of speech, you know, wrongly, so then, you know, it undermines everything. Whether it destroys the Beis HaMikdash, or, as it says in Rishonim, in the Sefer HaChinuch, that's why he gets tzaras. Tzaras is that the whole image of God, so to speak, on his face is gone. Because he's used the distinct power of speech, of connection, instead as a power of division. That's why we try to be so, so careful with the Koyach HaDibur, with that power. Now, as I said, the Gemara ends, but it doesn't end. It doesn't end with that. It's sort of the summation statement on the sugya. But then the Gemara goes on to speak about other things connected to the Churban. Al Haris Bavel, Sham Yashamnu, Gamachinu, Zachreinu, Asiyan. Somebody wants to turn the heat up a little more. It's fine with me, either way. There we sat when we remembered Tzion. And the Gemara speaks about different tragic stories, the children who were taken to Rome to be used in their houses of ill repute, and they threw themselves into the sea, and so on and so forth. But what I would like to go to specifically, the story of the Isha v'Shiva Banel, what we usually call the story of Chana and Shiva Banel, and the other asides. But the Gemara at the bottom really goes back to have its really its last discussion about Churban Beitar. And the Gemara makes the following interesting comments. Amar Rabba Bar Bar Chana Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Arboim saw ketzutei tefillin nimtzu b'roshei harugei Beitar. There were 40 measures of ketzutei tefillin, of the boxes of tefillin, the tefillin boxes, that were found in the heads of the victims of Beitar. Rabbi Yanai, Rabbi Shmuel Amar, Shloish Kupay Shalar Boim Arboim saw. There were 3 boxes, each one being 40 saw. In the Mishnah it says 40 boxes of 3 sa. Shal Rosh, Shal Yad, whatever it is. And then the Gemara says, Arba Kabin Mayach, 4 Kabin, which is a much smaller measure, of brains, were found 11 achas on one stone. Ula said 9 Kabin, and so on. And we say, that's Bas Bavel Ashaduda, Asher Shiyeches Venipitzes Alayach Alasola. They smashed their brains out, and in Alnaris Bavel, we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to show his revenge for that. So the Maral is troubled by this, and we're not going to get so much into the numbers which he discusses here. You have the 4, you have 40 saw is taras, purity, and mikvah, and he probes different things. But he says, 40 saw of ketzutei tefillin, what it reminds you of is, the storehouses of the Nazis, the truckloads of shoes and rooms full of eyeglasses and who knows what. So here it says 40 saw of ketzutei tefillin. But the Maral is surprised. He says, what's the big deal? You know what 40 saw is? A mikveh, a basic mikveh, is the size of 40 saw. The basic size of a mikveh is the size of a shower stall. So they filled a shower stall with tefillin. How many pairs of tefillin does it take to fill a shower stall? Let's say 1,000. I don't know. I have no idea. Okay? But to tell you something, the numbers of people that they say were massacred over here in Beitar, it doesn't seem like a whole lot. According to the numbers of people that were massacred in Beitar, you would imagine that would be much, much more than 40 sa, and even more than the other opinion, which says, 3 times 40 sa. It would seem to have been much more. The numbers just don't seem to be so dramatic. Nor, he says, the numbers of brains that we're talking about over here. Okay, so he's going to deal with his numbers. But what the real thing that I want to share with you here from the Maral of the story, is that is the emphasis here that he puts on the tefillin and on the meichos, because that's really what the Gemara is pointing out. Of all the things, there were this much tefillin, there were these many meichos, these many brains. Like, what's happening over here? So the Maral is going to say something here which is gewaldic, perfect for this week, being after all Erev Martin Luther. No, I mean the 2 days before Tisha B'Av, before Tu B'Shvat. I'm really doing well. Okay, 2 days before Tu B'Shvat. The word which he says over here is a yesod, a principle which the Maral says in a whole number of places, and it's a magnificent simple idea. His application here is creative. Right, but the idea generally is just a very remarkable idea. Where does the Torah speak about trees in the halachas of the Torah? We have a number of places. Torah speaks about the creation of the trees. Of course, it speaks about there's a mitzvah of orla. But there's a famous verse which the Torah uses when we have the iser, which we consider a general iser of bal tashchis, of not needlessly destroying something that's useful and usable. The Yisra of Altashis is originally said, Kisotzer Elir, when you lay siege to a city, and, when armies laid siege to a city, so, right, they did a lot of damage around the perimeter. And the Torah gives a specific warning that if you find there a fruit tree, so you should not destroy it. You should not destroy it. And the Pasuk says, Ki ha'adam eitz hasade, lovai mipanecha b'motzar. Now, that translates as, because the man is a tree of the field to come before you, to face you in the siege. The simple reading of the pasuk is with a question mark at the end. Ki adam eitz hasadeh lovai mipanecha b'motzar. I mean, is the tree a person? Is the tree one of the combatants over here that you should face him down in the siege? If he was one of the members of those foreign armies, then I understand very well. You know, chop him down, you know, destroy him. You know, but if the tree is not part of the battle, so it would be just some extra flourish of destruction, which is inappropriate. And therefore, the Pasuk says, don't do it. Is the tree a man? However, you just read the Pasuk, it says, Ki ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh. And so, already in Chazal, they said, man is like a tree. Man is like a tree. What does it mean? What does it mean, man is like a tree? You know, Ilan, Ilan, Bameh, Avarechacha. Man is also supposed to be able to produce, and so on and so forth. Maral says the following taich, the following interpretation of the comparison of man to the tree. It's got branches. Right? Got branches. Trunk. Right? Start at the head. Trunk. Get to here. You have lower branches. Get down here. Higher branches. A man is shaped like a tree. There's only one difference. There are two differences. What? Upside down. Upside down. That's exactly it. It's upside down. The roots, I mean, I guess these must be the roots, right? But the idea is, says the Maral, that man is an upside down tree. What's the idea? Because a tree is a physical creation that grows out of the earth, and it grows and it's alive, and it starts, so to speak, extending itself towards the heavens. You know, that's, you know, to some degree its vitality as it extends itself towards the heavens. But a human being, the root of a human being is in the Shamayim, is in the heavens. And what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was doing when he was creating a human being was, he was creating the human being as the vehicle to extend the Hashpa of the heavens down onto this earth. And that's the way a person's orientation is supposed to be. You can stand on your head from today till tomorrow, right? But then what you're going to be doing is that you're going to be saying that your main anchor, your main place is way down below, is the earth. That's why, you know, you find that Chazal view, when it speaks about the lowest points of man, literally, it speaks about the okay, about the heel, right? The heel is there, you know, on the earth. Oh, Adam HaRishon, even his heel, which was, you know, the farthest, the most remote, so to speak, from the heavens, and the farthest away from the head. The farthest away from the head. Ki Adam Eitz HaSadeh. A human being is supposed to be, in a sense, like a tree, but he's supposed to draw his primary form of nourishment from the heavens. And the head, being on top, the head is the root, right, to some degree, because in the head is where that is going to be seen most clearly. Chachmas Adam, the wisdom of a person, right, the understanding of the person. When we speak about the Yetzer Tov, we say that enters this person at the same time that he becomes a Ben Das, as a wise person. So that's where we're starting. That's the orientation of a person. Says the Maharal, what did they do in Beitar? Remember when we spoke about Beitar, we said Beitar was such a strong city, such a strongly constructed city. That was what represented Orim Bitzurei Sal Shamayim. And in fact, when they made when a child was born in Beitar, what did they do? They planted a cedar tree for a boy, a male tree for a girl, a different kind of a cedar tree, which was considered a female type of tree. And then when they would get married, they would cut down these trees and build from them the chuppah, right? Beautiful symbolic thing, because the cedar tree, the tree represents that which is implanted, that which is strong. However, says the Maral, Beitar was a city that was, again, like we said, like it's piggybacked on the Beis HaMikdash and on Har HaMelech. The strength of Beitar was not supposed to be just simply from those trees. It was supposed to be from the trees that were born at the time that the trees were planted. And those trees that were born at the time that the trees were planted were the trees that were rooted in the Shamayim, in the heavens. And what do we have that would be the expression of that rooting in the heavens? Well, on the one hand, of course, it's the moyach. It's the brains, right? The brains which are in the head, like we've been discussing. And on the other hand, that which expresses that connection, that which binds us to the heavens is The tefillin. The tefillin. The tefillin is there as the expression of bonding. When we they rastich li la'olam, right? It's the bond which a person establishes with between themselves and the Shamayim and the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. And it is true that we have tefillin on the head, and we also have tefillin on the arm. The tefillin on the head is supposed to be keneged amayach, corresponding to the brain. It's supposed to imply on the impact on the brain. The one on the arm is supposed to be keneged halev, corresponding to the heart. The heart, of course, the way we see it is, the emotions, is going to be the point of intersection between the brain, the head, the intellectual, and the physical. Right? They come together, you know, in, so to speak, in the feelings of the heart. But the tefillin represent that. And we say about the tefillin shebereish, the tefillin shebereish specifically, that on the tefillin shebereish it says, V'ro kol ame oretz, ki shem Hashem nikro lecha v'yoru mimecha. That all the nations of the world will see the name of Hashem, that it's upon you, and they'll be awestruck. They'll be fearful of you. They'll be so respectful of you. The shem Hashem is upon you, elu tefillin shebereish, that represents the tefillin shebereish. So that's to show that somehow Hashem is connected to us. That even though even our trunks are pointed to the heavens, but they're very far away, the tefillin is supposed to somehow, you know, extend it a little bit. In that sense, make it a little bit closer. Says the Maral, so in the destruction of Beitar, it was the head, so to speak, that was uprooted. The heads of the people of Beitar were uprooted. Because if their strength on this earth, in a certain sense, was physically represented by the trees that were planted in the ground, the root of that strength on this earth were the heads that were planted in the heavens. And so the Gemara emphasizes that in the destruction of Beitar, it was those nebuch, those brains, it was the tefillin that were lost, that were representing that bond of the person down here to his real root in the Shamayim and the heavens above, that was found to be undone. That's the idea that the Maral says. And I just want to conclude the section with a little bit more of how the Maral explains this. You know, there's a din in tefillin that says, we call it a din in tefillin or a din in avelos, that an avel, la'aleinu rachmanos, on a person who loses a relative, on the first day can't wear tefillin. What does that mean? Well, an onein, before the person is buried, so they don't do any mitzvahs. Right, they're potter from all mitzvahs. They're just not allowed to do things which are forbidden, but they don't daven, they don't wear tzitzis, they don't wear tefillin either until the burial happens. An onein. When the person is buried, however, they become an avel. And even if, let's say, if the person dies at 9 o'clock at night, right, and they're buried at 8 o'clock in the morning, and the person's back from the cemetery, and it's 10 o'clock in the morning, they won't put on tefillin. Because it's Yom Rishon. We hold, it's a machlokas haposkim, our custom is that even if the person died on Monday and they were buried on Tuesday and they come back on Tuesday from the cemetery, they still won't put on tefillin, because we consider Yom Rishon to be the day of the burial, not the day of the death. Why does an avel not wear tefillin? Even when he's mechuyev, well, right, once the person's buried, he's obligated in every other mitzvah, right? He would wear a talis. Right, he would wear tzitzis, he would make brachas. Why is he potter from tefillin? Because, says the Gemara, because an avel is mu'ulal ba'afar karnai. An avel is sort of writhing in the dust. He's anything but glorious. And tefillin is called pe'er. Tefillin is your glory. Pe'er chachav shalach. Pe'er chachav shalach. Your glory is upon you. So therefore an avel can't wear tefillin. That's why we don't wear tefillin Tisha B'Av morning. Right? In a certain sense, similar thing. So tefillin is called something of the beauty of the person. It's the pair, it's the glory, it's the crown. It's the crown. Now, let me just say something which the Maral doesn't say over here, and then we'll go on to what the Maral does say. You understand that an avel, what did he just face up with? He's faced up with a person going to the dust, which is the reminder of what Adam Arishan was told, where he said, You're going to go back to the earth because that's where you came from. Atshuvcha l'adama ki mimenu lukachta. Ki ofarata, because you're dust. Vel ofar tashur, you're going to go back to the dust. When a person is a mourner, they feel and they see the roots of a human being in the earth, not in the heavens. In the Rishonim it says that's why a kayan is not supposed to become tamei lemeis, is not supposed to come in contact with a corpse, because the whole notion of the kayan is that he's focusing on cultivating as his central mandate, as his life's task, the connection to the heavens. So when he comes in contact with death, with mortality, you know, it's a contrast to, you know, to what he is. And if we understand that the tefillin somehow is to symbolize, you know, the roots of the person in the heavens, you understand why the avel perhaps doesn't have that, can't wear them at that point in time. But the Maral goes further, and the Maral says, what has the Gemara continue and conclude with the city of Beitar? Bnei Tzion ha'yekarim ha'mesuloyim bapoz, the children of Tzion, the children of Yerushalayim, of Eretz Yisrael, who are precious, who are mesuloyim bapoz, who are like coated with gold. My mesuloyim bapoz, what does it mean that they were coated with gold? Ilema dahavu mechapi bapiz, that means literally they were covered with gold. Of course it doesn't mean gold-plated children, but what it means is that they were wearing garments that were face embedded with gold and with jewels and beautiful things. Vami debei Rav Shila, Tarti miskele istiri piza nachas ba'alma. Two measures of coins of gold came down into this world. Chada b'raymi v'chada b'kulei alma. One was in Rome and one was anywhere else. Which means that to describe the people of Yerushalayim as being so golden, when that was really the strength of Rome, it seems strange. It seems strange to describe it that way. Rather, says the Gemara Ella, Shoyumeganin es hapoz b'yayfion. They would make gold look pale in comparison. So the Maral says, and the Gemara goes on with a whole number of other such things where it describes this thing of the beauty of the people. The Romans, they found these beautiful children, they wanted to mate them with each other, all these agaritas. And he says the beauty was pe'er. When we talk about normal material beauty, so we say, oh, that Rome got that stuff. Rome got that physical stuff. But there was a unique, transcendent chen, a favor of beauty, that was more beautiful than gold, kelilas yaifi, that was the province of the people of Beitar. And just like tefillin might not be the most beautiful thing physically in the world. You might be able to come up with something that's physically more beautiful, but it's the pe'er, it's the glory of the people, because it's a glory and a greatness which is based on that connection to Shemayim. That was the beauty of Beitar. That was the beauty of Beitar. And there's more to talk about, but we're gonna conclude the perek with that. But in this perek, where we focus more than anything else on Krach Beitar, so we have here the conclusion. Krach Beitar was the Jewish people's mega building project, was showed the strength of what they were able to build down here on this earth. And we said, wow, Yisrael, they have the Migdash, which was a tremendous spiritual place, and Har HaMelech, this prolific production of Jews. Krach Beitar is, we can build something magnificent on this earth. And it's true, we built something magnificent, strong, on this earth. Orim b'tzureis l'shamayim. However, in this conclusion, what we see is that whole thing was a Kol Yaakov connection. It was the connection of heaven and earth. It was the tefillin. It was the pe'er, was the glory, beautiful building, which was indeed to connect the earth to the Shamayim. And in fact, it stands in contrast to that other great building, which was Ve'agad lo Shemecha, to make my name great. Remember, as we said early on our first encounter with Krach Beitar, we said, oh, at the Dor HaFloga, the generation of the dispersion, they built a tower that was supposed to go up to the heavens, right? And that was going to make for themselves a name. And then Hashem knocked it down, and he chose Avram from all those people, and he said, I'm going to make your name great. So he said, oh, make your name great. That's also a great building project. That's Beitar, right? Just like he said, Vavarecha, I'll give you blessing. That was the Migdash. Vagad l'shmecha is, I'll give you many, many, Vavarecha, you know, excuse me, Bibonim, Vagad l'shmecha is with wealth, right? Yaschol Gagol is with children. Vavarecha is with money. Vagadla Shemecha is with the building project of Beitar, the three aspects that we'll have of Lecha going to Eretz Yisrael. But what was the difference between the building project of Dor HaFlaga, that didn't know how to use their voice, was that they were building a tower to make themselves a name. The Chazal said they were going to war against the heavens. They wanted to make a break between the heavens and the earth. Let the heavens not rain down on this earth anymore. Right? Destruction or blessing. Avram Avinu, his building project was Reishai Bashamayim, was with its roots in the heavens. And therefore, that's how the Gemara ends and tells us about Beitar, with its tefillin, with its mochos, with its meichin, with its brains, with all of these things, with its transcendent beauty. It wasn't the beauty of the gold that was mined from the ground and from the rivers, but it was a beauty which was the pe'er that was at its roots in the heavens. Mi'at Hashem, we'll continue next time with Perek Ches. I want to mention to you, to mention to the people who aren't here, Mi'at Hashem, that Monday night, tomorrow night, is Tu B'Shvat, and we're going to have Mi'at Hashem and get together in my house. We'll call it Tu B'Shvat. Right, bring your tree trunks, and Mi'at Hashem, you know, whatever. There's mirrors and learning a little bit about Tu B'Shvat at 8:30 Mi'at Hashem. The other thing I want to mention is that the next 2 weeks, I'm leaving next Matzai Shabbos to Eretz Yisrael, and I'm coming back the following Monday morning. Next week I won't be here, but I've asked somebody to substitute and give the shiur. Rabbi Ari Storch, who's a very capable Baal Machshava, a very capable teacher, and I hope you'll. He's not going to exactly continue where we are, but he should give some fascinating shiurim at this time, and I would appreciate if he would be honored with your presence, as I always am. Okay. Thank you very much.